And now we are here to talk to Alan Raymond, author of How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Back in 2002, one of the races in New Hampshire was said to be exceedingly close, as NPR reported.
The race for U.S. Senator from New Hampshire is among the tightest in the nation. The latest polls show that Democratic Governor Gene Shaheen and Republican Congressman John Sununu are in a statistical dead heat. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
By the time it was over, the race wasn't so close. Republican John Sununu won the Senate seat by a margin of close to 20,000 votes. But that wasn't the end of the story. As it turned out, a GOP operative ran an illegal scheme to jam the phone lines of New Hampshire Democrats just as party workers were trying to help voters who needed rides to the polls. Alan Raymond eventually went to jail for his role in the scheme. He's now out and has a book titled, again, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Party Operative. In it, he says, dirty tricks are way too common in politics, and reforms are needed. If you want to talk with Alan Raymond, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. We swear the lines won't be jammed. That's 1-800-989-8255. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks
for having me. I guess you got to take your lumps on this, right?
Absolutely.
So refresh our memories about what happened on November 5th, 2002. What did you do?
Well, actually, the way it finally came out, it was simply just kind of a crank call. But what it turned out to really be was against the law. I was hired by the New Hampshire Republican State Committee to essentially do as you explained, jam the phone lines of a Democratic operation on Election Day to make calls to help people get to the polls.
Had you ever heard of this sort of thing being
a tactic
in politics?
I've seen a lot of things, but that was a very unusual thing when I got the call to come in and to get hired to do it. And so it was very unusual, but the New Hampshire Party proceeded to do it, and I was the vendor.
And so what did you do to make sure that not only was it unusual, but that it wasn't illegal, which it turned out to be?
Well, not enough, obviously. But what I did do was I consulted with an attorney. I got a call from the regional political director of the RNC originally. To ask me how it could be done or if it could be done. And I said, you know, of course it can be done. Anything can be done, really. The next call I made was to an attorney who I knew to see if it was legal because it was so unusual. And I didn't get it in writing, but I did get the green light that he didn't recommend it. He didn't see it being illegal. So we proceeded, and the New Hampshire Republican State Party became my client.
Now, you were known as a savvy political operative. You made lots of money doing direct phone calls. But when I relate to people this story, their first reaction is, how could he possibly think that was legal? I try to tell them, having read the book, you'd be surprised what's legal. But what's your answer?
Well, my answer is, first of all, you know, the political contests are not moral contests. Your job, or your duty, like anything else, is to stay on the right side of the bright side of the law. And so one of the things I learned working at both the Republican National Committee and the National Republican Senatorial Committee is, well, if there's some doubt, ask an attorney. And if the attorney says, no way, don't do it, then that's your answer. And if the attorney says, well, you know, I don't necessarily recommend it, but it's not illegal, well, then, you know, you might as well go up to the very bright line of the law and try and not cross over.
That's called your job, I guess.
Well, your job's to win. Your job is to engineer a victory. That's what you're hired to do.
Give me an example of a legal thing or some of the legal things that listeners might say, wow, I never thought of that, and I wonder why that's legal.
Well, let's see. Let me go back to the book. I'll give you an example of really – what you do is particularly if we're talking about phones, mm-hmm. is you use demographic predisposition. So you can make some determination about a household based on its demographic data. And from that, I'll give you one example. Say you know of a union household in a Democratic district. You might call into that district with an accented voice. Maybe that accent sounds like a Latino or Hispanic caller and talk about how great NAFTA is. That might be one thing. But in other words, it's ways to essentially manipulate voter predisposition.
So what you'd be doing, for instance, is you'd be finding maybe a blue collar or Eastern, in one example you gave was there was an Eastern European household or group of households that would be prone to vote Democrat. So you would actually hire someone to read a script in an accent, maybe an African-American accent, who supposedly agreed with those people's positions, the Democratic position. But your thought was that because of the accent, it would scare these people away from the Democratic candidate.
And that's what I mean when I say predisposition.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Now, those calls tend not to be live, but they tend to be automated phone calls, and they tend to be left on voicemail as opposed to delivered to a real, you know, a living, breathing respondent who's on the phone at the time.
Right now, are there a lot of voice actors who know more than anyone else the sorts of things that go on in campaigns?
I'm sure there are. Yeah, I used to have CDs of actors and you know, really those that I would go to all the time because they're just good talent.
One thing that you pulled, which was of questionable legality, was the Super Bowl call. Could you tell us about that one?
Yeah, well, that was a call that was delivered during the Super Bowl. And the idea there was obviously to deliver the call to give emphasis to the message. So obviously, if you get a call during the Super Bowl, you're certainly going to remember it. And in that specific instance, what was done was the position, without getting too complicated, because there's some complexities there. It's New Jersey politics, and there's some geopolitical calculations.
Yes.
But was essentially to deliver the position of one candidate in a Republican primary and their position on abortion, which was contrary to another candidate, both being from the same region of the state, so that the recipient of the call would remember the call because they got it on during the Super Bowl, and would also react based on their own predisposition, their own position on that issue.
But the underlining bit of genius, if you want to call it that, was it would seem to be by and about one candidate, which wasn't the case. And what callers would remember is, I can't believe this candidate interrupted me during the Super Bowl
to tell me about their position on abortion. That's exactly
right. And you were hired by the other guy.
That's right.
So were you ever an idealist who became disillusioned, or did you start off in politics just thinking, all I care about is winning?
No, absolutely not. In fact, and this is an important point for your callers and why they should pick up my book, politics is a business. And one reason you know it's a business is because it has graduate programs. I've actually got a master's degree in political management. There's master's degree for lobbying as well. And so it is a business. It's a cost per contact business. So what that really means is people who get involved to run campaigns, they're not doing it. Some may,
mm-hmm.
but I would say probably the most of them are not doing it for ideological passion. They're doing it because it's a great career. It's exciting. You get to do it's certainly not a 9-to-5 job. There's an entrepreneurial aspect to it. You kind of got to eat what you kill, so you have to be good. But it is a business. It is no longer people saying, I'm going to go out there and fight for what I think is right. It's, you're going to hire me because I'm good at what I do.
And along the way, you gathered mentors, you collected some enemies. One of your mentors, or at least the person who helped you, was Haley Barbour. An enemy was George W. Bush. You never cared for him or his tactics. But when you chose, or I guess it was chosen for you, who you'd like and who you didn't like, was that based on anything other than who could help you? Was it based on what their policies were?
No, in the beginning, it's what's available to you. I started so low on the rung in this business, I had to reach up to grab the first rung. I mean, I was way down at the bottom putting up yard signs in Bergen County, New Jersey. So in the beginning, when you go into it, it's just about where you're going to get your job. As you go through it, you might have a bit more of a luxury of who you can work for. And as you said, I chose not to work for George W. Bush, President Bush, for personal reasons. I just didn't want to work for him. But I wound up working for Steve Forbes, so that shows you how savvy I was. But I think you can have that luxury, but more often than not, it's about the economics of it. Who am I going to work for that's going to win a primary, go through the general election, and hopefully be elected and then becomes a long-term client?
How did you develop your niche in the world of phone calls during elections?
Well, I think I did it just by way of how I used to run campaigns. I always relied heavily on the telephone. I learned that in graduate school when I took my first course in quantitative methods, and I realized the reach of the phone. I mean, I think of the phone as like a way to get into somebody's household and almost deliver a 30-second spot. It's really highly targeted, in my opinion, if you're doing an automated phone call. Another way to use it is reach into the household and get data back. And the best campaigns are data-driven. And so I guess I just developed it through plying my trade and getting better and realizing the reach of the phone.
Given that TV commercials are seen by everyone and every member of the press can look at them not only as they air but online, and the campaigns are pretty proud of releasing their TV commercials, do you think the media in handicapping races overemphasizes the role in TV commercial and misses the role of direct mail and direct calls, which kind of go under the radar?
Yeah, it depends on the race you're talking about. At this point in the presidential race, for instance, which is everybody's focused on, it's media-driven. Headlines, these are the types of things that shape the race. When you're talking about congressional races and Senate races and even your local races, yeah, absolutely. It's the direct mail, radio to some extent, the internet to some extent as it matures. But yeah, those are the things that really go unnoticed because they're not, you know, they're not as prominent. They're not on television. And, you know, remember, particularly in the Northeast, not everybody can afford to get on television. So those become the main mediums how candidates communicate.
Are they also nastier in general? Could you get away with anything?
Oh, you can get away with tons. I'll give you an example. Immigration. I mean, it's amusing to me to watch the debate about immigration right now in the country. I was flogging that issue going back to 1994. And one way to flog that issue is, you know, the right picture of someone climbing through a border fence sent to a Puerto Rican household in the right district could activate that household to be very anti-immigration, which means you're taking what should be a surefire Democratic vote and you're either putting it in question or moving it to the other side.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. What percent of your direct calls could have just come from a candidate's stump speech? I mean, things that you were just pretty much happy to say and didn't care if anyone knew it. And what percent were things that you were a little devious about, either where it came from or the message that you were giving?
Well, you know, look, any communication that a campaign pays for, I said earlier, you know, it is a business. It's a cost per contact business. So you don't just put any old message out there. You think carefully. It's data-driven, or at least it should be, and it's all geared towards moving votes. That's the whole point. This is not a, you know, there's a message box, and the message box is what you say about yourself and what you say about your opponent and vice versa. You want to keep it as much about what you say about your opponent and yourself as possible. And so anything that you pay for, you better have thought very clearly about what you want to say, and it better move numbers.
David in St. Louis. Hello, David.
Hi. I was I guess for lack of a better term, a disenfranchised voter in the 2006 congressional election. Someone from the state Secretary of State's office told me pretty much in uncertain terms that I heard you use the term earlier, a Republican operative, mm-hmm. was nice enough to register me to vote in a county down in the south of the state where I've never stepped foot. And by being registered in two counties, I wasn't eligible to vote in that election. I had to vote provisionally, which is something akin to not voting at all. And thankfully, everything that was very important to me managed to pass. But I was more or less knocked out of the process for that particular round. I've cleared it up with them since then. But I have little doubt that I was essentially profiled and picked out as, yeah, that's one of the guys that we're going to go register in some tiny little post office in the middle of nowhere in the boot heel of Missouri.
Alan Raymond, you ever hear of this tactic?
Well, more importantly, yes, to some degree. But I think the larger issue is a phenomenon called vote caging. And I remember being taught about vote caging when I was finishing up my master's degree and even being taught about it at the Republican National Committee's Campaign Management College. And vote caging, for your listeners, is you essentially what you do is you pick a section, a geopolitical area. You mail letters to that area first class to voters who you think probably no longer exist or are somehow disenfranchised. They're migratory or for whatever reason. If they don't live at that address and that comes back, you can then use that to challenge votes at the polls. So, you know, maybe this caller was victim of that. Or, you know, the other thing, and I point this out into the book, is, and really the message of the book is, and I think this is important, is ask yourself, why me? When I get a piece of mail, a phone call, I see a television spot, whatever it is, ask yourself, why me? Why is this candidate telling me this particular message? What do they think they're going to trigger me to do? And that's really the one of the messages in the book that I think is very important. I'm trying to teach the reader the language of the art.
Why you, David? What do you think?
I really don't know. I mean, as far as St. Louis County goes, we do live in a Subaru-driving type of community. I don't think it's too hard to pick out a random household and figure they're very likely to be a Democratic voter. And I think that's more or less it. I mean, I think if you can pick out, you know, three or four households on every street, maybe less than that, maybe three or four households in every particular, you know, neighborhood, you can impact a small precinct like ours fairly well, I would have to imagine.
All right, David. Well, thanks for the call. And, you know, the question I was asking myself, I think Rory may be asking as well. Hi, Rory, you there?
Yeah,
Hi, go ahead. You're from Utah. What's your question, Rory?
Well, my question is, I'm wondering if there is at least an emphasis difference between the parties, Democrat and Republican. I've just read or heard a number of people coming out talking more about the inside tactics, and they tend to particularly be from the Republican Party. And I guess I'm wondering if he has noticed a difference, I guess, in the emphasis of sort of winning at all costs.
Okay, because that is a narrative that I've heard, too. What do you think of that? It's an honest question there, Alan, and thanks for the call, Rory.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. First of all, let's not fool ourselves. You know, both parties are equally to blame. They both use questionable tactics. You're seeing it now in the Democratic primary, whether it be Clinton staffers being fired in Iowa for talking about Senator Obama going to a madras and being a Muslim, to flyers down in South Carolina, which, you know, criticize Governor Romney and bring into question his faith because of multiple marriages. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think, look, it happens in both parties. The tactics may be a little bit different, but let's not fool ourselves. Both parties are out there doing the same thing.
And finally, quickly, is there an honest man in politics? Are there some candidates that this stuff just won't fly for?
Well, yeah, I think it is sometimes up to the candidate. However, you know, the ideological candidate doesn't always win. It's tough to cut through all the clutter to get your message out there, and sometimes that's why these tactics are put in play.
Alan Raymond's book is How to Win an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. He joined us here in 3A. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Mike Pascoe.